Support for Midwest Swing is brought to you by baseball.
The Zone Coverage Podcast Network.
Hey, this is Chris Jimenez, and you're listening to Midwest Swing on the Zone Coverage Podcast Network.
You can put it on the board!
Woo!
Everybody, we are back here for another episode of Midwest Swing. You can find us on Twitter at Midwest Swing Pod. We're part of the Zone Coverage Podcast Network, which you can find on Twitter at Zone Coverage MN. I'm your host, Brandon Warren, and you can find me on Twitter at Brandon_Warren. We're coming at you here with pitchers and catchers reporting today for the Minnesota Twins. It is Valentine's Day, February 14th, and so a big day for Twins fans getting excited for the upcoming season and to see how the Twins can jump off that 85-win season that saw them get to the postseason last year. A couple of questions the Twins have to answer yet. How are they going to be able to stem the tide of Irvin Santana's injury, if he's going to miss the first month of the season or even the first 2 weeks? But also getting a starter in the mix between him and Jose Barrios so that the Twins have at least a formidable 1-2-3 if they have any chance of making the postseason. One guy who is involved with a team that the Twins have talked to in recent weeks is Jason Collette, and he's my guest today. Jason, what's going on, man?
How you doing, bud?
I'm doing good. Where can we find you on Twitter? Where can we find your writing?
So I, on Twitter, am at Jason Collette. There's two L's, there's two T's, and an E at the end. If you don't put that E at the end, you're going to get some independent musician in Canada who knows nothing about fantasy baseball, but he apparently gets a lot of my tweets. And then you can find the writing on theprocessreport.net. That's the Rays centric blog. And then if you are a fantasy baseball player, you can find my stuff at rotowire.com.
And you guys have had some pretty great writers at the Process Report. Tommy Ransel, RJ Anderson, was he there as well?
He was. And Tommy and RJ started it.
Yep. Terrific baseball minds. I've kept up with RJ. I don't know what Tommy's up to right now.
Tommy's doing some stuff with ESPN. Okay. He does a lot of stuff on some freelance stuff there at ESPN. And then so the blog now is run by myself and Jason Hanselman, who is at Sandy Casimir on Twitter. Does just a phenomenal job. If you're into a lot of the visuals, looking at, he takes a lot of the data that he scraped out and just makes some fantastic visuals. So if you go on the site, in fact, there's a Minnesota Twins preview on there. If you want to link to it in the blog post, and yeah, he's got a lot of good information there.
We'll find it. So is that technically what data viz is? Is that data visualization? Is that what that's considered? Is that something else?
I don't know. I mean, he does all this through Excel, as far as I know.
It looks phenomenal. I mean, he really is great. So I have to give him a lot of credit because I've learned a lot about the Rays from looking at those visualizations. And it's a team that always intrigues me. It's intrigued me dating back to the Joe Maddon days, even still with Kevin Cash. You know, it's just a team that always seems to be right in the mix, even if you want to count them out. This year's team, to me, is a little bit different. And again, I'm not telling you anything you don't already know, but I want you to let me know if there's anything I'm missing. When I look at this team, I see a fairly good, if, you know, young starting rotation, an offense that I'm not really sure how they'll score runs, and a bullpen that's strong on the back end, but there is a lot of pieces that are interesting, but not necessarily established, that are kind of the bridge to Colomy. What am I missing here?
Yeah, it sounds a lot like every team for the past few years. As Eno Saris said in his piece when he talked about the Oakland A's a couple of days ago, it is a low-run environment. And it's a team, because it's a low-run environment and things can go either direction in any one game, it could be a 75-win team. Or if you listen to Pecota, it could be an 84-win team. And then, I mean, Pecota loves Tampa Bay as much as I love eating at Pizzeria Lola when I'm in the Twin Cities.
Nice.
Every year they're up there, and they've underperformed the last couple of years. The first year, maybe it was new manager with Kevin Cash. Last year, I thought he did a better job of things, but a lot of things didn't break their way. It's tough to, yes, Logan Morrison came out of nowhere, but then Brad Miller did nothing. So, those kind of things balance out. Kevin Kiermaier missed a big chunk of time. The middle part of that bullpen was very soft. And when the starters got chased early, that middle part gave up that lead. And this year, it could be a lot of the same thing. I mean, defensively, the team looks really good on paper. Getting Denard Span and moving him to left field should help. You don't have a very high bar in left field for defense, but getting him out of center makes him better out there. And then with Kevin Kiermaier covering center, that certainly helps. And Souza's really good in right field. Infield defense should be in good shape. Going from Longoria to Duffy will be interesting to watch. Echevarria comes back at second base. It's kind of wide open right now. And then at first base, maybe that's finally the defensive home for Brad Miller right now. And all this is being said while they wait for Willy Adames and Jake Bowers to come up from the minor leagues.
Yeah, so it sounds like there's some players who are extremely interesting, not far off. And there always seems to be pitching at Jacob Faria or Faria. There's Brent Honeywell. There's some guys who are interesting there. With that said, if you had to decide right now or kind of think about it right now, is like 80 wins just like last year? Is that kind of the balancing point of where they should get to if everything is just normal?
Yeah, if everything's normal, I think it's a 500 team. Because if you look at, the starting pitching has depth, and that's not even counting. I'm not even talking about Brent Honeywell yet. I'm not even bringing Matt Andrees or any of the other guys. There's some depth here, so they can move some pieces. And it really depends how the team is managed. I think one of the things that Kevin Cash talked about in the offseason is really being more cognizant of that times through the order penalty. And you and I were talking on Twitter the other day. I think Jeff Zimmerman was involved as well. We're talking about Chris Archer coming off back-to-back, or maybe it was a guy replying to one of your tweets saying, why do we want Archer? He's had back-to-back four ERAs. And a lot of that is how he's been used. He's been left in the game too long. And that's one of the things Cash has said, okay, I need to do a better job of that. In his first year, they did a good job with Nate when Nate Karns was on this team. I mean, when the 19th guy was announced, Nate Karns was coming out. And Nate Karns hated it, but it was really good for him because the numbers said he was terrible that third time through. And Chris Archer has been terrible in that third time through the order as well. I mean, just last year, 364 weighted on base average against that third time through. That's suboptimal.
Yeah, what's 364? That's like what a peak. I mean, that's like Evan Longoria, isn't it? I mean, when he was
That's an above average hitter. I mean, he's got a big time through the order penalty. So if they're more cognizant there, the same thing could be said for Oda Rizzi. Same thing could be said for all of these guys. But if you're going to do that, then these guys have to be more pitch efficient. And that's really where Archer's had his problems. We're talking, 4.5 pitches per plate appearance, and that adds up rather quickly. And then you've got to have the deep bullpen. So I'm curious to see how they're going to execute that, because a lot of these guys do have options. One of the things, if you look at their current roster construction, Alex Colome out of options, Dan Jennings out of options, Chaz Rowe out of options. Sergio Romo options don't matter. He's good, but everybody else has options. So they can just cycle these guys up and down to Durham and bring back fresh arms. So maybe they do bring in some of these guys and say, you're throwing two innings. And right now they got Nate Eovaldi put in the rotation. I'd argue he's that guy for that bullpen because the durability has been a problem. The consistency of a third pitch has been a problem. And he's probably the poster child for times through the order because his third time through is absolutely horrendous. So I'm just curious to see how they're going to use this team in camp. And, they've also got Jose De Leon, who was highly touted coming out of the Dodger organization, barely pitched last year, and how they're going to utilize him. So I'm more excited about the pitching stuff. I think the offense is going to be a flashback to the earlier part of the decade where it was pitching and defense is our DNA, or we're going to try to scrape together some runs. That's kind of how the team feels offensively, but pitching, I'm really excited how they can put this stuff together, even if they do move one of these arms.
So Eovaldi kind of seems to me a little bit like a Michael Pineda clone in that, they got all the measurables you'd want from a pitcher, just not the whatever the finishing touch is, whether it's home runs, durability, or whatever. And now we see the Twins having signed Pineda. Am I far off there? I mean, do you see the similarities or not necessarily? Because obviously they both throw gas.
And that's one of the funny things with Pineda is he and Archer are a little weird in that They're the only two pitchers in the last I remember doing a play index search over the winter before I did something out in the first pitch forums in Arizona. Pineda and Archer are the only two pitchers to have like a strikeout rate of 10, a walk rate below 3, and then an ERA of 4 or higher. That's it. Just those two guys. So it's kind of funny to see how they add up. But with Eovaldi, I mean, plenty of velocity, but it's a low spin rate fastball. He doesn't really get the swing and miss. It's that slider and the breaking ball where he really gets the swings and misses. And then we don't know where the splitter is. I mean, there was a lot of talk about the splitter, how it was one of the lowest spin rate pitches by StatCast, and it was getting a lot of ground balls, which was great. But even then, you would think when a guy that has the heat and has a slider, all of a sudden he had something that goes the other direction, he should get better against lefties, but he didn't. He got worse. But we didn't really get to see a full season of the splitter usage because he started it, I think, middle of 15, and then he got hurt in 16, obviously, mm-hmm. missed all of 17. So I'm curious how that's going to work out. I mean, ultimately, I think he ends up in the bullpen, and right now he's just in that spot until they're ready to bring Honeywell up after they've conveniently managed his service time.
Yeah.
With Pineda with the Twins, it's a guy I liked before he was hurt, and I'm curious to see how he gets brought back as well.
Yeah, it's going to be fun, too, not to bring up a sore subject, but seeing Josh Koch move from Tampa Bay to the Twins. I'm interested to see what he's able to bring to the table in terms of analytics pitch-wise. I have to ask you, I mean, he's pretty well-regarded in that sphere or in that realm, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, not a lot of what he's done has been publicly out there. It's like we know that apparently he was one of the early leads on the seeing in the pitch effects data when guys were showing arm fatigue. Okay. Like if their arm slot was dropping in the game, hey, why is Joe Maddon going out there to get that guy? He's throwing good. Now we're pulling him out of pitch 82. And that's really the only thing that we've really heard about it. And just he's been in the organization so long. And it's, new opportunity for him. We'll see how that goes. But that's really how I remember his impact is, why is he pulling out? And you go back and look at the data once Brooks Baseball would have it up. You look during the in-game, I can see where that was. Sometimes when a guy would leave and later become injured, you can go back and see that drop in velocity, drop in arm angle, that type of thing.
What I like to see from the Twins, as much as it probably hurts other organizations, is when you start stealing talent from smart organizations or teams that do it the right way. James Rouse, and hitting coach for the Cubs and the Yankees, those teams both hit. You talk about going and getting Josh Koch, who obviously pitching has been a big part of the foundation there in Tampa Bay, going to get Jeff Pickler, who is their bench coach now, from the Dodgers. Again, a team you want to steal talent from. And so too is their scouting director, whose name is escaping me right now. He got hired like a week before Gabe Kapler took the job with the Phillies. It makes you wonder, if Kapler had left beforehand, if he would have been promoted. A guy younger than me that's a farm director, Jeremy Zoll, I think it is. I think he was born like late 80s, early 90s. I mean, crazy how much talent there is in the game that's this young. I like to see teams, you look at the NFL and there's such a churn of like, Wade Phillips constantly gets rehired elsewhere. Or Rex and Rob Ryan, Rob Ryan more specifically, Greg Williams, all these guys that get churned through as it's kind of the old boys club. I kind of like to see teams innovate and not necessarily bring back. Again, I know Chris Bosio was a good pitching coach. Jim Hickey moved on and, kind of gave him the heave-ho to the point where now he's in Detroit with Ron Gardenhire. Speaking of guys who've been churned through. But I like that creativity. Give some guys who, have a new voice an opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're a parent, but your child's young. I have a 12 and 10-year-old, and mm-hmm. sometimes the same thing that I tell my kids over and over again, I see them ignore, but then one of my brothers will come over and tell them, and they'll listen to Uncle Aaron or Uncle Brian.
Yep.
I'm like, man, I've been saying that same thing for like 3 months now, and you're going to listen to them. It's just sometimes it's a different voice gets through.
Well, have you ever watched The Office?
I'm a former educator. Yeah.
So when Michael Scott doesn't have kids, he says, well, nobody ever rebelled against a fun uncle. Like that's kind of true. Dynamic, you know what I mean?
That is true. And I used to be a classroom teacher. Same thing. I would tell a student something, didn't sink in. Next teacher was like, yeah, I have no problem with Brandon. He's doing his work for me. Great. So yeah, sometimes it's just that new voice and that new angle and the new approach. For some of these kids, they go through the organization. You're seeing sometimes there's a consistent philosophy within an organization, but other times – It's yeah, I like my low A coach, my high A coach, and double A, and sometimes those coaches move along with them. But I like seeing the new blood. I'm really excited to see what Gabe Kapler is going to do up with Philadelphia.
Well, I like the Phillies organization too, because not only am I, you know, have I talked with Kapler a number of times, but you got the Terry Ryan connection from Minnesota, mm-hmm. Andy McPhail, all that, you know. So it's an organization that I'm familiar with. That's nowhere near here. So if I'm going to have a fondness for an organization, it helps that it's not a Central Division or an AL team. So I can kind of split my interest there. I got to ask you, if you had to pick between Kevin Kiermaier and Byron Buxton defensively, would you be able to?
No, they're so much fun to watch, both of them. They both are insane with the amount of ground they can cover, with the throws they're able to make. I appreciate their aggressiveness coming in on balls. A lot of guys, when you're watching the game, for me, one of the most frustrating things are guys that when the ball's in front of them, they don't want to make the play. They'll short hop it. And I see Buxton go after those balls. I see Kiermaier. If you make an aggressive mistake like that, I'm good with that. Mm-hmm. Especially, you know, if your left field and your right field are out there backing you up, it may cost you an extra base. But if you can make that play, go make it. Don't let that ball just fall in front of you. And I appreciate that their willingness to do both. It's exciting to watch both guys play. I just hope that they can both avoid injury. I mean, Kiermaier, it's been a problem for Kiermaier.
Right.
That's really been the only thing holding him back. Every year you see growth in that guy, especially at the plate. I mean, early on the approach was bad, but the approach is getting better. He's not doing He is aggressive on the base pass, but not running into as many mistakes as he did earlier. It's just I would like to see a full season of him on the field.
So the MLB.com depth chart, and I know that's managed by, is it Roger Mooney that's the MLB.com guy there?
Bill Chastain.
Oh, I'm thinking of Mooney's different one of the newspaper guys with Mark Topkin. Yep. So they have Denard Span as the third center fielder, and they don't have him listed in left or right. I'm not really sure why that is. But they got Malik in left, Kiermaier in center, Souza in right. What is the onus on this team to get Span on the field? Are they really feeling like it, or are they probably more likely to flip him? Even though I know Tampa Bay is his home, or Tampa is his home, Tampa mm-hmm. Bay I know is in the city. You know, why isn't he reflected as anything semi-meaningful in the depth chart at this point, or is it just kind of a clerical error, do you think?
I just think it's a clerical error at this point. If you look at roster resource, they have him lead off in left field. I'm not crazy about him hitting lead off. I'd rather have Dickerson back there. I thought Dickerson did an excellent job hitting lead off last year. And when you look at his numbers starting to decline, it's because it was when he was moved around the lineup. Mm-hmm. I mean, they could flip him. He's obviously the highest paid player on the team. It's a little weird for roster construction. You mentioned Malik Smith, also a lefty, also limited to left field. Not good. He's not good in center. Everything we said good about Buxton and Kiermaier, we can say the opposite for with Malik Smith out there. So it's really an odd fit. They need another right-handed outfield bat on this roster, and right now that guy doesn't exist. If you look at the way the depth chart's shaken out, so it'll be interesting to see how that particular situation plays out. But for now, if they're not going to make a deal, I would expect Span to be the mostly everyday left fielder. That said, they are committed to cutting more payroll. Maybe they can sell Span to the Athletic. Hey, you know, I think you and I are the only, you know, so maybe they could do that. But yeah, they're committed to doing payroll, and even moving Odorizzi is just one piece of that.
Yep.
You've seen Colome in the trade rumors, those different types of things. So while he's here now, he may not be there on opening day.
So speaking of moving payroll, Evan Longoria, obviously the shining beacon of everything that's been Tampa Bay baseball pretty much since they've come around, was moved to the Giants. Brief aside, that Giants uniform, the cream color, the aesthetic is just unbelievable. You get it on like a guy like Brandon Crawford with that flowing mane, and it works. You know what I mean? It just works.
It does. And it's a great uniform.
Yeah, it's a great uniform. So Evan Longoria is going to be handsome as hell out in San Francisco in the Bay, playing in the coldest stadium in all baseball. Anyway, What was that like to kind of come to grips with him being done being a Ray, whether it's as a fan, as a person who has watched him, as a person who analyzes his play? And again, I know it hasn't been as great as it was at the beginning, but I mean, he still was a reasonably good player. What's it been like to kind of rationalize the fact that he's not a Ray anymore?
It's the only player jersey I've ever owned. You know, I've got some other generic ones. He's the only one that I still have hanging in my closet. It was probably tougher on my kids. I mean, honestly, the time to deal him was before last season, but they truly thought they had a contending club last year.
Well, they weren't far off, to be fair.
I mean, the projections had him 84 to 86 wins. If that's where the projections have you, you absolutely should go for it. You can't decide, you know what, I'm going to sell my best asset, because he was coming off one of his better years. And again, they thought they had a contender. It just didn't work out for them.
Well, the Twins got in with 85 wins for the second wild card, too. So don't lose sight of the fact that if they reach their projections, they're in.
Right. Yep. And so that's where it came down. So when you look at the end of the, when you look at the return, it's still, they obviously like Christian Arroyo. So it's still a good return. It's a good return for them, considering where Longoria is on the age curve and where his salary was. But I mean, the time to trade him was last year. They didn't. They tried to make the run. Things fell apart for them. That's what happens. So, you know, we kind of all had come to grips that this was going to happen a year ago. And now that it finally happened, it still was shocking to see the news like, hey, he's been traded. You know, I think it would have been, you know, if they, I really don't see him trading Chris Archer, just because that contract is so incredible for the team. Mm-hmm. And back, if you think back to the Longoria years, all the stuff that they were able to do 6-7 years ago was because of that original deal. When he signed that 6-year, $18 million deal, thank you, Eric Hinsky, for convincing him to do that. And then nice. He signed the second extension. You know, that allowed them to do all the other stuff they could do, because they've always balled on this budget. I think the highest payroll they've ever had may have been just shy of $80 million. You know, they have never been a big spending team. So that contract is what allowed them to do that kind of thing. And now it's Archer's contract that's enabling them to put a team together on paper that Pakoda says has a chance at a second wild card.
So when you look at the potential of moving Odorizzi, I mean, it couldn't come at a worse time because of how he pitched last year in terms of nearly 2 home runs per 9. Again, it swelled up, you know, MLB-wide to, I think it was like 1.30 was the average in the American League for a starter. But how do you value him if you are not only the Rays GM, but an opposing GM? You know, if they truly covet Max Kepler, it's got to be hard for Thad Levine to say, yeah, well, you know, we think Kepler's on the upswing just based on what we see. And they can only really look at the stats for Odorizzi. You know, when you have a guy, you know their past, you know their health and everything. How do you sell Odorizzi if you're a GM as someone who can, you know, get back up on that bell curve and be a 2-2.5-3 win pitcher moving forward?
Yeah. I mean, Odorizzi's another one of those guys. When I talked about the times to the order, he's another one that really should be managed like that. And I mean, ideally he belongs in the National League. So he has to be pulled. And maybe his spot in the order is going to come up. They're like, okay, we're going to go ahead and pinch hit for him and not let him hit for himself here. Because that's one of his things. That last year, that's really where he paid the price. I mean, I think we said Archer was 363 weighted on base average. Odorizzi was 377 last year.
Wow.
That third time through the order. And that's where it really hurt him. Plus, you know, he pitches, you know, he's one of the guys that works off effective velocity. His fastball looks good because it's got a lot of spin rate. He throws it high in the zone. And then when he gets in trouble is when he misses his fastball command location or he hangs the changeup. That's his two primary pitches. I mean, he used to throw really good curveball. When he was on his game, he was using that curveball to steal strikes early and then spotting the fastball and then putting guys away with the changeup. But he's gotten away from that curveball here recently. It's been frustrating, honestly. You know, until Blake Snell turned himself around, Odorizzi was like the game that I got frustrated watching because he couldn't get out of his own way. And then when he would make a mistake, he would compound it with body language type of thing where he'd get frustrated that he'd try to overthrow a pitch and leave it right out in the zone. And there goes another home run type of thing. But when he's got all of his stuff working, he can be an effective number three starter. So that's a ceiling though.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not easy to evaluate then, and it might be tough to see a deal. And again, at this point in the off season, with the guy still available on the trade market or the free agent market, it makes a trade kind of tough to sell.
That's right.
If I have, this is not a hypothetical, I do have a $9 Blake Snell and Otto New. I'm always a believer in pedigree and the fact that guys are not always who they are when you first see them in the big leagues. We saw it with Greg Maddux. We saw it with Curt Schilling. Francisco Liriano even had like a 5-something ERA the first time he went through before he was nasty in 2006. Am I likely to be happier with Snell this year than I was last year?
You should be. I mean, and I think he came around last year. I mean, there was a point he got sent down to the minors last year because he kept making the same mistakes over and over again. And there was talks about him being uncoachable. I was talking to one of the other guys who gets some behind the scenes coverage stuff. And he's like, I could see guys rolling their eyes behind him when I was talking to, when we were talking to him and he was making his responses. So that was one of the things. I was like, wow, that's an eye opener. But then he got sent down. He was 0-6, but he really closed the season out well, came back throwing strikes, using his curveball, using his changeup. And if you go back and watch how he closed the season out, once he came back from that demotion into September through September, that looked really good. And that's, like you said, going back, there's a reason why this guy was considered a top five prospect in baseball not too long ago. And you can't write that off. It's one thing if he had been, if he had been seriously injured and missed a bunch of time, but that hasn't happened. It would be one thing if he's not throwing as hard as he used to. And he's throwing now mid-90s. When he was coming up, he was 97. You think about that first start he made at Yankee Stadium in his debut. And, he struck out 11 at one point at one of those outings and was throwing 97. Now he's like 94, but he's doing better with that because he can hit his spots and he's not overthrowing. But that's really the key for him is when he gets ahead, then he can use that huge breaking ball and really do some damage with that. When he falls behind early in the count, he just keeps throwing more fastballs. And just the way the league is, everybody's out there hunting for fastballs right now. You can't pitch from behind. I mean, even you go look at like Carlos Carrasco last year, as nasty as his stuff is, his fastball gets beat around too when he throws it too much. So these guys got to get first pitch strikes. That way you can expand the zone. And, the race isn't as much as that first pitch. And this was a big thing Jim Hickey was a huge proponent of is the getting to that 1-1. It's that third pitch. You're in a 1-1 count. The difference between going 2-1 and going 1-2, I think it's worth 150 points in OPS. I forget the exact number, but he was a big proponent of that. He was a big proponent of that. It's like, what do you do with that within those first three pitches? Are you going to get to 3-0, 2-1, 1-2, or are you going to strike the guy out? So that's where I saw a lot of growth with him last year and down the stretch there, and I'm excited to see what comes of him this year.
What's your level of shock that Logan Morrison isn't signed yet?
Pretty high.
Yeah, I mean, granted, there's no QO on him, which he played well enough to justify one, though I suspect he could accept one. If we knew the market was going to be this slow, then he would probably have done that. But you see what Yonder Alonso got. They both kind of did the elevate, celebrate thing, a few more walks, a few more strikeouts, kind of embraced that type of skill set. I know that Alonso faded, went to Seattle, wasn't as good with power, but man, Morrison, I think, would look great in the Twins offense, and I know that's convenient for me to say because this is a podcast listened to by mostly Twins fans, but it's just hard for me to see an offense where he doesn't fit. And I know his Twitter account was kind of weird, but the more I've read into him with the Lung Foundation stuff, the fact that the Rays unretired number 5 so he could wear it, I feel like he's probably not a bad clubhouse guy either, so I don't really understand why he hasn't landed somewhere unless he's really expecting more money than people really are willing to give him.
Right. I didn't hear any bad reports from his time here. I mean, ideally, it's really tough not to imagine him going to like Colorado either. And you look at their depth chart right now, Ryan McMahon's at first base right now. Good prospect for them. But
he's only played like, what, 17 games in the big leagues with like a 140 average or something?
Exactly. And then last year they were trying to put Ian Desmond there. It's like Morrison there makes so much sense, and it hasn't happened. But I mean, that market is drenched with, if you want all power, low average, you got Lucas Duda, you got Adam Lind, who could still really hit right-handed pitching well. Yeah, and Mark Reynolds the other direction. I mean, there's a lot of these pieces, and I think since we have had no movement after the Alonso signing, then I guess they're waiting for one more of these guys to happen. Because the Alonso contract pretty much should have set the market. It's like, okay, this is what you're going to get.
Yeah.
Take it or leave it. And maybe some of these teams or Kansas City's like keeps holding out hope that Eric Hosmer is going to come back. And then if he doesn't, okay, we're going to go ahead and throw money at Morrison. So we have some offense there.
But I think that team is screwed.
Shoot, these guys are coming. I think they are too.
No, they're screwed.
But Morrison, I think, he goes to Colorado. That's a difference maker. I mean, everybody was talking about heading into the offseason, the Rockies need to get some more offense.
He'd hit 50 homers.
As crazy as that sounds.
He could hit 50 homers.
He could.
And that's
he's going to get hurt in Arizona.
Yeah,
now with the human over play.
That's true. That is true. What can you tell me about Derek Shelton, who was a hitting coach for the Rays? Now he's in the Twins organization.
You know, the weird thing about him, because the Rays struggled offensively for so long, everybody wanted to point a finger and say it's Derek Shelton's fault.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I lived in Florida and I was still covering the team on a part-time basis and talking with different people, everybody had great things to say about him. You know, nobody was saying, yeah, this guy, his approach is weird. Everybody backed him. You know, even some of the other media folks talking, there was never any bad words about him. But publicly, there had to be a fall guy. And it didn't help that as soon as he left and then Chad Mottola came in, the team started hitting right away. Everybody's like, aha, see, I told you so. That was the problem.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think he was a fall guy here. And I didn't have full access behind the scenes to see what type of instruction he was giving people. But there were some guys underneath him that did well. There were some other guys that regressed. And, you know, there were some guys that seemed to flourish under Mottola when he came into play. But, you know, it is – hitting coaches do so much work behind the scenes, but they get blamed for a lot of stuff. What happens in front of the cameras?
Sounds to me a little bit like Tom Bernanski here, even though Brian Dozier credits him with totally revitalizing his swing. And Brian Dozier had more home runs in like his first decent season than his entire minor league career. So it's tough. So I got a couple more things here before I let you go. Tell me about this stadium deal. They're trying to strike a deal in, is it, how do you say, Ybor City?
You got it.
Okay, well, then I
Ybor City, the home of cigars and the home of Cigar City Brewing Company. If you are ever down there, you need to go check that place out. It is a phenomenal beer. A lot of different good brews under their brand. But they want to put a stadium right there in Ybor City. I think you go to RaysStadium2020.com, I think is where they have the plan. It looks great on paper, just like it did back in 2008, late 2008, early 2009, when they wanted to put it where Al Lang Park is, or Al Lang Field, that had the old sail design.
That reminds me a little bit of the Twins wanting to put their first stadium where the Guthrie is now. I know you're pretty familiar with Minneapolis, so they're originally going to put it right on the river, which would have been pretty cool, but that was like 1997, and then by 2007, I think they signed the deal, which I guess 10 years for you guys as well. Then Target Field gets signed into the bill by, I think, Tim Pawlenty at the time. So maybe it is a similar situation where they still get their stadium and it's in a good area, but just a different area than originally expected.
Right. And I mean, it should help because it'll be on the right side of the bay, the body of water. People may think, oh, it's just a couple of bridges. It's more than just a couple of bridges. If you get on that bridge in traffic, it feels like that bridge is 20 miles long. I lived in East Orlando, and when I would drive over for games, if I didn't leave my house by 3 o'clock, it was gonna be tough for me to make first pitch. That's how bad the traffic could be sometimes. But that Ybor City area, I could be there in an hour and a half from East Orlando. That was easy, and it's right off the. Right off the Leroy Selman Expressway, the toll road, so it's easy to get to. So I would pass that area all the time on my way to Tropicana Field. So it brings you a lot closer to the population base. There's more, if you look at population density maps, there's a lot more people in that area, and it gets you closer to the business because ultimately that's where baseball teams make their money. It's those sponsorships and the partnerships and getting those people to pay for the suites and all of the big offices. Like 90% of them are over there on the Tampa side of that equation. Then you got it again. I said hour and a half from East Orlando, Disney area, not too far. It's not that hard to get down there as long as there's no accident on I-4 because it is the only way to get over there. But they've got all the plans. You know, they know where they want to put it. They've got some mock-ups for the stadium apparently. What they don't have is a funding model. And the team has said on paper they're willing to pay up to $150 million, which is probably a third of the cost. Yeah. I am in the camp where you should be paying – the ownership should be paying for as much of that stadium as possible because public funding of stadiums has never been as – it's as good of a return on investment as buying a car. So I'd like to see them do a little more in that regard. But they've got to move, and if they don't, then if this doesn't happen, they're out of the market. As attractive as that television market is, I mean, Tampa Bay itself is a top Tampa Bay market is I think is 13th and Orlando was 19th, or maybe flip-flopping those numbers. But if you combine them, they're a top five television market.
Yeah, you got to capitalize on that.
Which is why they want to keep that team there. Say what you want about the attendance, but the television ratings have actually done well over the last couple of years compared to the attendance. But Major League Baseball doesn't want to give up that market,
right?
Which is why this has got to work.
Yeah, nor should they. So the elephant in the room and the thing that I got to ask you that will go into depth, probably a fair amount of depth here before we let you go. What is there a compelling reason to expect the Rays to consider trading Chris Archer? I know you said not really because of how good the deal is, and in fact, if he were to be somehow declared a free agent, a la Ricky Henderson on Little Big League, he could command not far from that per year. And so this was a $34 million, 30 some odd million for 4 years. Yep. I bet he'd get, $25, $28, $30 million per year on a free agent deal. So it is a great deal, but can you see any compelling reason for them to consider moving him? Short of, getting Ronald Acuna from the Braves or, a deal like the Cubs gave gave the White Sox for Quintana.
Right. I mean, if somebody blew them away with an offer, like you said, what they got for Quintana, maybe. Or if they had a legitimate fear that throwing all of these sliders over the years is a ticking time bomb for his elbow. Mm-hmm. That's honestly, those are the only two things I would consider. I mean, when you look at this contract, the way it's structured out, he's due $6.4 million this year, $7.7 million next year, and then I think it's $33.75 million over the next 4 years.
Yeah.
And he's being paid like a middle reliever, and that's what Addison Reed's making this year on the average.
Right.
So you've got an SP1, low end SP1, but an SP1 making what a setup guy is making. So that's really where that deal. And if you move him and Odorizzi is dead man walking for the roster. It's not if he's going to be traded. It's when. So who else is going to step up? Somebody has to pitch and take a good amount of innings when you're trying to get. Teams will say they want 900 innings from their starting pitchers. Somebody's got to do it, and that's the one thing Archer can do is give you those innings. Like I said, some of those later ones get at risk if they wait and hold on to them too long. But that contract is the linchpin of everything. If they trade him, they may as well blow it all up and go what Oakland's doing right now.
So if the Twins come to them and say, look, we're not going to move Royce Lewis, but you can have anything else you want in this farm system, Is there something there, or is it just that's really the only primary chip, and it's just got to be Royce Lewis?
I mean, it has to be. I mean, they're in the driver's seat. They have the leverage here, and if they can just sit around and wait for the offer they want, but it's so rare you see teams go out and do that and be like, all right, fine, I'll give you two of my top five prospects, and I'll give you this guy that you can use right now. Let's go ahead and do that. With this contract, there's no rush to do it. I mentioned earlier about Longoria, the time to really trade him was the previous season. With Archer, if they don't trade him this year, oh, well, he's only making $7.7 million next year. You can trade him next year. He's still extremely affordable. When you're talking about Darvish getting three times that this year in his base contract value. So there's no rush there.
So if I come to you with Romero, Gordon, Kepler, and Kirilloff, you guys are still running the other direction. It's not close.
Most likely, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I mean, I don't think they'll move Royce Lewis. I think they believe he's the Carlos Correa of their own. But that's just how good Archer is. I get it. I totally get it. And the fact that Twins fans want him shows you how good he is in a lot of senses. But also, like you see Seth Stowe's posting, it was Romero, Gordon, Kepler, and like 60% said, oh, that's too much. I'm like, are you effing kidding me?
Yeah, fans are always like that. And then the thing is, when you're trying to make the push for a new stadium, it's already tough that you've traded Longoria. If you trade Archer, I mean, yes, fans love Kiermaier and everything.
Yeah.
But Archer, if you want to go the whole quote-unquote face of the franchise, it's Chris Archer. He is a tremendous mouthpiece for the sport, for the area, for everything. He's just a phenomenal human being in that regard. And like for me, as long as I've been watching this team, I've been watching the team, I moved to Florida from Texas in 1988. You talk about like you'd like to watch the Phillies. Mm-hmm. So I grew up on the Astros. And then when I moved to Florida, there was no professional baseball, period. So I was stuck watching the Orlando Twins. And so I was able to watch, you know, I got there just after the team that had Tim Laudner and all that. Mm, yeah. So I got to, you know, I was there in 88 through. And so we didn't have professional baseball until the Marlins came along. And I was like, I'm not watching the Marlins because I already have a National League team. So when the Devil Rays came along, I was like, okay, now I have an American League team. And then Bud Selig had to go screw it up and move the Astros to the American League. So now I'm a little torn, especially, you know, every time the Astros and Rays play one another. It was cool to see the Astros win the World Series last year, but yeah. Now, you know, my childhood team and the team that I've watched since day one are now in the same league. But if they traded Archer this year, man, that would be just about enough for me to unplug from the team.
Well, I got to ask you something completely unrelated, not to diminish your feelings towards Archer. What is a fair amount of enthusiasm to have for Taco Fall? Just because, I don't know. I mean, I feel like he misses a lot of games, but he just seems like he's a really fun box score watch.
He is, man. He
he's
is.
Talking UCF basketball here, if people don't know. He's,
yes, this looks is like, a 7 foot like six
Eddie,
center.
He looks like Eddie Murphy in Bowfinger, I think. I don't know. He just looks goofy, but man alive, I think he's so fun.
It's a game changer to watch him play. I mean, I'm 6'4", and he makes me feel like a midget when I walk by.
I stood
next to him. I had my daughter on my shoulders. We went to a game over when they played East Carolina in Greenville last year. Yeah. And I put her on my shoulders, and he was still taller than the two of us like that. But it is he's a massive person. I hope he gets into the NBA and
Me
does
too.
Something.
Me too. Yeah,
it's just he's out for the year now. Unfortunately, hurt his shoulder, which you know, I can relate to because I've had 3 shoulder surgeries. But he and Johnny Donkin's son were supposed to be two of our 3 best players, and both of them are out for the year with shoulder injuries.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, unfortunate. But they're playing USF tonight, and that's our arch rival, and we hate USF, so I hope they win.
Boo. Go Knights, boo Bulls. Well, thank you so much for taking the time. We'll keep a close eye on the Rays. We'll keep a close eye on Jose De Leon, who could have come over in a Brian Dozier trade. And hopefully we'll see you around Target Field if you find your way to Minneapolis here this summer.
Oh, I hope so. It's honestly one of my 3 favorite ballparks to go to.
Awesome.
I've been to it 2 or 3 times now, and I love going there.
You bet. Well, thank you so much for your time. @JasonColette on Twitter. You've been listening to Midwest Swing, part of the Zone Coverage Podcast Network.